Nodding. The former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, has been shot in the leg at an anti-government rally. The Bishop of Oxford has said the Church of England should allow same-sex marriage. BBC News.
And this evening's newsreader was Jane Steele. Comedy next on Radio 4 as we join Alexei Sale in his imaginary sandwich bar. And would you believe it, it is in fact National Sandwich Day today. I think that qualifies as a coincidence.
Most wanted podcasts on BBC Sounds.
Where is the missing crypto queen's billionaire scammer?
It starts to get very scary, very, very fast.
How did gangster's drug baron finally get caught?
He was taken completely unawares.
Why were Burnwild's environmentalists labelled eco-terrorists?
For a long time, they were getting away with it, but that wouldn't last.
Uncover a new case while the dog drags you out for a walk. Listen to True Crime Podcasts on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4 with more uncompromising views, Alexei Sale's imaginary sandwich bar is open for business.
I refuse to use emojis. I think that makes me seem more interesting. What I do is I write it out in full instead. So in a text I'll write, sad crying face emoji. Or pile of poo emoji, or smiling face with heart-shaped eyes emoji. The Japanese graphic designer Yukio Emoji, when he developed the emoji in 1987, was simply trying to design some sticky labels to go on fruit and had no idea what it would lead to. Sometimes us old people take to new technology and sometimes we don't. Both me and Linda had elderly parents who were extremely problematic to buy presents for on birthdays and at Christmas. But they could get extremely nasty if they didn't like what you'd bought. One Christmas we got my mother Molly a present we'd spent months searching for. And as soon as she saw it, she said, "Oh, I was hoping you weren't gonna get me one of those." It was a sort of sleeping bag that fitted on her wheelchair. So she'd be zipped up warm when I took her for walks. Thing was, she really liked it, so she got to use it constantly without ever expressing any gratitude at all. Which was a win-win as far as she was concerned. One piece of new technology both our mothers really took to was the paper shredder. There was a point in the early 2000s when suddenly paper shredders were in all the shops. Argos, Currys, Ryman's. Like before, paper shredders were just a rare piece of office kit used only by diplomats and the Secret Service. And suddenly they were on offer for a few pounds everywhere. So we bought one each for our parents, and they loved them. The only problem was that you couldn't stop them shredding stuff. You'd put your hat down and zip! I was doing a book reading of my first volume of memoir, Stalinette My Homework, at an art centre in Crosby, just outside Liverpool, just before it came out, and my mother came along in her wheelchair and she heckled me. She shouted, "Lies! Lies! It's all lies!" The first time I was on TV was in 1980 in a comedy show called Boom Boom Out Go the Lights. And the next morning I called Molly and said, "Well, what did you think?" And she said, "Well, I don't think Keith Allen was very good either." The biggest thing was I bought my old mum a house, and there then began a 30-year battle between us to get her to say thank you. Molly reminded me of General de Gaulle's remark on how he was planning to thank Britain and the United States after they had liberated his country from the Nazis. He replied, "We will stun them with our ingratitude." During our rows, I would shout at my mother, "Why don't you say thank you to me for buying you this lovely house?" And she would yell back, "Why don't you say thank you for me buying you all those clothes and all that food when you were a child?" To which I'd reply, "You had to do that by law. If you hadn't bought me food and clothes, they would have locked you up." Oh, here we are at my imaginary sandwich bar.
Behold my sandwich bar, Peps at bargain prices, where all you cheats and thieves and liars come for rolls and custard slices. 'Cause humanity is cant and vanity, but underneath it all, a man's a man which does enjoy his daily sandwich.
Hello everybody, I'm Alexis Ella, welcome to my imaginary sandwich bar! Over here is the pretend counter, behind me is the illusory coffee machine, and in front of me the non-existent customers. Here's one of them now. Hello, mate. Good to see you again. What can I get you?
Hello, Alexis! I'd like a baked potato with cheese and baked beans.
Certainly. I'll just sprinkle on the cheddar, then slam it in the microwave. There you go, mate.
Thanks, Alexis!
Hang on a minute. Did you just take a Fanta out of the fridge and put it in your pocket?
No, I didn't!
Yes, you did. I saw you.
No, I didn't. Why would I?
I don't know, but I want you to either pay for it or give it back.
It's a stupid Fanta. Doesn't matter. I've just nicked £3 out of the tip jar.
Why, you? That was Jeff Bezos. Creator of Amazon, and according to some accounts, the richest man in the world. All newspapers, major websites and TV channels, which are universally owned by the rich, tell us that the rich are absolutely fantastic people, wonderful and brilliant, while the truth is that they're actually a thieving pack of bastards. In a paper in the American Journal of Psychology in 2008, it was revealed that people with incomes over $70,000 a year shoplift 30% more than poor people earning $20,000 a year. And the rate of shoplifting goes up exponentially. So people earning over $100,000 a year shoplift 60% more than poor people. Until, well, you get to the likes of Bezos, who makes $1 million a minute. He steals everything all the time. And Elon Musk is even planning to go into space so he can steal even more stuff. Why do they do it? The philosopher Bertrand Russell said, experience has shown that there is something which rich people desire even more strongly than wealth, and that is to keep others poor. So if you're missing a fiver or you don't know where your nice gloves have gone, it's most likely because Elon Musk has pinched them. And to what end? So rich people can compete with each other for who has the most stupid garbage. You know, Jeff Bezos doesn't have a super yacht like the other oligarchs, but goes one better. He travels everywhere in his own luxury tram. So before he visits a place, streets have to be torn up. Compulsory purchase orders have to be made on houses and shops. Rails laid, tunnels dug. The Elon Musks and the Jeff Bezoses, the tech disruptors, the cyber pirates, they say, question everything. But I say, why should I? Compulsive hoarding is seen as an illness, but what is extreme wealth if not hoarding? Except instead of old newspapers, broken furniture and cat crap, you cram your house with designer handbags and crap by Damien Hirst. For them to be able to carry on their greedy hoarding unimpeded, the rich have to control the levers of power. A huge number of politicians, including two of the last five prime ministers and two recent chancellors, went to rich people's school, Eton. You know, every time somebody at Eton becomes prime minister, every boy at the school gets a day off, as does every coke dealer and dominatrix in central London. Boris Johnson, David Cameron, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Kwasi Kwarteng. Honestly, that school should be in special measures. And they've wheeled out old Etonian Rory Stewart again, haven't they? And people going, ooh, Rory Stewart, ooh, Rory Stewart, ooh, I really like Rory Stewart, ooh, Rory Stewart, he's the acceptable face of the old Etonian Rory Stewart, Rory Stewart. Rory Stewart voted about 26 times for austerity measures, and he does a podcast with that evil bastard, Alistair Campbell. Don't think he's nice just because he looks like a bleeding monkey. You know, this is absolutely true, but I've actually dandled a young, old Etonian, Jacob Rees-Mogg, on my knee. When I was at Chelsea Art School, my tutor was a woman called Anne Rees-Mogg. She was a wonderful person, the sister of Times editor William Rees-Mogg, father of Jacob. Anne was obsessed with her nephews and nieces and was always bringing them to college. And I would pretend to be interested in them too. And that's how I came to dandle a young Jacob Rees-Mogg on my knee. Now, there's these historic counterfactuals, these theories of history that wonder what would happen. What would be the moral thing to do if you, for example, met Hitler as a baby? You know, I worry about Jacob Rees-Mogg. I worry what he'll do when his looks go. Jacob Rees-Mogg, vain, ruthless, greedy, could have almost sprung out of the pages of a Dickens novel, couldn't he? In Bleak House, Dickens wrote about an unexplained phenomenon which achieved almost epidemic proportions in Victorian times. This was something called spontaneous combustion, where people were found sitting in their untouched homes but burned to a crisp. Of course, we have something similar in our modern age where people are found sitting in their untouched homes but frozen to death, but that's called having a Tory government. And of course, during lockdown and the pandemic, the rich have prospered massively while the poor have got much poorer. In the week before everything fell apart in March 2020, when it was just beginning to dawn on us what kind of trouble we were in. Yeah, that's right. I'm doing lockdown material. You don't want to hear it. I don't want to do it. But this stuff happened to me. In March 2020, I was performing five nights of stand-up in Liverpool. The Guardian later described that show as the best stand-up comedy of 2020. Of course, it was pretty much the only stand-up comedy of 2020. On the Saturday before lockdown, we took a cab from our flat to the gig. The driver was one of those fat, depressed guys in shorts. I always think, wouldn't you be less miserable if you had some proper trousers on? He was saying, oh, town's dead, mate, it's absolutely dead. But the theatre was full, and it was nice to see that people would rather die than miss my hometown gig. Like a lot of other people in the early days of lockdown, I got into wild swimming. Well, I fell into the canal one night when I was drunk. I did a lot of cleaning the house, but it was frustrating because I was always able to get the place spick, but I was never able to get it span. And you remember illegal block parties? At the start of the lockdown, there was a moral panic about young kids organising illegal block parties. And a friend of mine in his 60s, but still a bit of a hipster, fancied going to one. So he found an invitation on the dark web. But before they'd revealed the address, there was a questionnaire, and there was a box that said, are you over 18? So he ticked the box, and a message came up that said, well, sod off then. Now, is it safe to criticise Captain Tom yet? Those early days of the whole Captain Tom madness reminded me of the week after Princess Diana died and nearly the whole country went collectively mad with a 17th century level of mob hysteria. The week that Diana died, you kept your bleeding mouth shut, mate! If anybody had voiced anti-monarchist sentiments in a pub down the Walworth Road, you'd have got your head kicked in! And the same was true of the Captain Tom insanity. People said, Captain Tom, he represents Britain. Well, yeah, if you think an old man whose best years were during the war, staggering round and round his enormous garden in an effort to prop up our failing health service, represents modern Britain, you're probably right. Now, of course, the Charity Commission are investigating the manner in which the Captain Tom Foundation was set up and run. Though I personally think that that terrible song he did with Michael Ball counts as a war crime. This government is cracking down on protest and freedom of expression. According to the crazed right wing, the left, the woke, are the greatest threat our civilization has ever seen. But just look at the reality. The right controls all finance, all of the military, all media, all of the energy sector, all manufacturing, all railways, all buses, all airlines. While we, the woke, get to throw a statue into a river. Once. It's brilliant comedy material like that, which meant the last series of this show, the Alexei Sayles Imaginary Sandwich Bar, won an award, the BBC Audio Award for Best Scripted Comedy of 2019. I felt it was a reward for all the hard work I put into creating these shows. I particularly try and make them relevant to younger people. Now, younger people see the world very differently these days, but I try and stay in touch with what they think. Bitcoin, TikTok, Harry Styles. And that's why I'm popular with a younger demographic. The other day, I was buying a sandwich and a bag of crisps in the supermarket, and the young man behind the checkout asked me, "Do you want to grab a drink?" And I said... I said, I'm terribly flattered. I think I'm a bit old for you. He said, "No, the drink's included in the meal deal." A recent survey found that 1 in 10 British men, and this includes young men, only change their underpants once every 2 or 3 days. Now, I change my underpants 3 or 4 times a day. Well, we won't go into that. But how did the polling company find out this information? After all, nobody would admit to being so unhygienic. Well, the way they do it is they run them over. Your mother was always worried you'd be hit by a car and you'd have dirty underwear on. And it's true. The polling companies to get into fast cars, run men over, and then pull down their pants. It was great to be getting awards again. Years ago, I used to win loads of them, like Best Comedy Series at the Pi Radio Awards in 1980, which later became the Sony Awards for my show, The Fish People. This prize occurred so far in the past that Pi, the award sponsor, was a British-owned company which manufactured electronic goods. Tape recorders, radios and TVs in an actual factory in the UK. Can you imagine such a thing? Then in 1988, I won a Sony for my starring role in Lenin of the Rovers. Lenin of the Rovers was so popular it was released by the BBC as a double cassette. Set. For those of you who don't know or can't remember what a cassette is, it's sort of like a podcast, but made out of a transparent plastic box and half a mile of brown tape wound around little polycarbonate wheels, which you could listen to on your Pi cassette machine. After the BBC Audio Awards, getting out of the taxi, I dropped my award, a piece of solid glass, and chipped a corner off. Somebody told me about a guy who could repair it. An awards designer himself. As he worked on my damaged trophy in his studio, this guy told me that normally he wouldn't take on something like that, as it was beneath him. But he was doing it because of this show and the theme of pretending, the notion of putting on a false front, of living an imaginary life. That was very close to his heart. He said that when he'd been young, his favorite television program had been The Saint, starring Roger Moore. What he liked most was when Simon Templar visited somewhere impossibly exotic like Marseille, Salzburg, or Tangiers. Far away foreign towns whose streets, even to a 6-year-old, always look suspiciously like the back end of Elstree Studios. Once in Marseille or Tangiers, whatever the state needed for his mission, guns, plans of the main post office, a hot air balloon, was always available via some old pal who lived there. At the age of 40, looking back on his childhood enthusiasm, he had begun to wonder whether the TV program you watched most attentively when you were a kid was an accurate predictor of how your life wasn't going to turn out. Because he, unlike Simon Templar, didn't have any friends at all. It turned out there was something about friendship that he just didn't get. From time to time, he would try to make friends with a person, but would always get some detail hopelessly wrong, like sending them a whole ham after they'd had coffee together once. Or telling them that he thought Hitler's moustache looked quite smart. And he often thought of growing one just like it. He would have been quite happy to live like this, except that although he had no friends, he actually knew a lot of people. Neighbours, business associates, shopkeepers, and suppliers of the materials he needed, and they kept bugging him to come to dinner or go on a date with his sister. He told me he was Britain's top designer of awards ceremony awards. If you think about it, those trophies that people hand out to each other, the Vegetable Retailer of the Year Award, the People's Choice Insect Exterminator Cup, or the annual Social Worker of Courage Prize, those twisted sculptures or figurines, misshapen pieces of perspex and metal, have to be designed by someone. And he was the best in the business. Indeed, so successful was he that he had won the Awards Designer of the Year Award 4 times. You'd think that that award would be amazing, but in recognition of the potential problems of rivalry amongst awards designers, the Awards Designer of the Year Award is a cheap plastic trophy purchased every year from a heel bar in Wood Green. One day after he turned 40, he was having a meeting with one of his precious metal suppliers who was going on about how he had just been to visit an old friend in Italy. "So what are you doing this weekend?" the supplier asked. Unable to admit to the empty 2 days that were in front of him, thinking of the saint, he said, "Oh, I'm off to Edinburgh to stay with a couple of mates who design new soups for Baxter's." Paula and Mike. Upon proclaiming this lie, he felt a wonderful sense of lightness descend on him. He wasn't a boring, lonely person anymore. He had friends in Edinburgh. The lightness persisted until that evening when a cloud of worry suddenly replaced it. What if the supplier saw me hanging around town, he thought. In the end, he decided he needed to leave town for the whole weekend, just to be on the safe side. Going all the way to Edinburgh seemed a bit too much, however, so in the end, he booked a bargain weekend break at a travel lodge just outside Telford Newtown. It was a dull weekend, but worth it, simply to be able to tell people he'd been staying with friends in Edinburgh. From then on, once a month, he would leave town to stay with a growing number of imaginary pals. There was Annie Atherson, a free-spirited children's entertainer from Bude in Cornwall, the Corbels from Nottingham, and Les and Linda Carew, who lived in a lovely little cottage just outside Banbury. The staff at the Travelodge got to know him well, and in turn, he got to know by sight some of the regular guests. There was one particular middle-aged woman who, over the next 6 months or so, he saw several times. One night when he was drinking alone at the bar, he overheard her talking on her phone in the lobby. She was saying to the person on the other end, "Oh yes, I'm at the circus now. Carlos and Carlotta are going to be doing their knife-throwing act in about 5 minutes. Afterwards, the whole lot of us are going to an Armenian restaurant." She could, of course, been deceiving a lover, but as he watched her eat a solitary dinner, the awards designer thought he recognised her and was certain she was doing the same as him. The next night, he got to the dining room before her, and when she entered and was seated, he forced himself to approach the table and said in a rush before he could stop himself, "University Librarian of the Year." "I'm sorry," she said. He repeated, "University Librarian of the Year Award. You won it. I designed it." A slow smile spread across her face. It turned out she loved her trophy. A concoction of magnets and ancient vellum, coated in platinum and mounted on a plinth of clear plastic, inside which were tiny carvings of the leading figures of the European Enlightenment. In It had pride of place on her bookshelf, even though it interfered with her broadband signal. It was a shock when she said she wanted to join me. Well, yes, that'd be great, he said, drawing up a chair. She said, so I've seen you here a few times. Yes. You like spending weekends just outside Telford Newtown? No, I think you know why I'm here. And like that, it was out there. In a torrent of words, they poured out the deception they were playing on their acquaintances and the dangers of being caught out through lack of corroborative evidence. She said, you know, what we need is a network of like-minded individuals who once a month could pretend to be our exciting friends. We could make confirming videos, forge restaurant bills, post stuff on social media, etc., for suspicious people back home. They'd be friends who'd help us out with our fake friends. At first, he was puzzled by what she was saying. Then it came to him. It's a flight of fantasy. How delightful. Then another thought hit him. This is it. This is friendship. I'm sharing a flight of fancy in an easygoing fashion with a friend. After that, they spent an enchanting evening together, almost finishing a whole bottle of Travelodge red wine. They told each other all kinds of things, shared all kinds of inner thoughts and biographical details. Round about a quarter to 11, she asked, when are you next visiting someone? In a month's time, he replied, I'm pretending to visit some Hindus I know in Leicester. I'm telling people I'm going to a 40th birthday party in the Highlands, the woman exclaimed. So they agreed to meet back at the Travel Lodge in a month's time. He slept more profoundly that night than he had done in years, but in the morning rose from sleep with a burgeoning sense of unease. He remembered the night before, but now it seemed like the recollection of an operation conducted under an epidural, something horrible and intimate that had happened to him while he had been cloaked in a false feeling of euphoria. Why the hell would I want to know her cat's name, he thought to himself, or what her feelings are about the vegetable celeriac? He was almost tempted to skip the buffet breakfast, but as it was included in the price, he could not quite manage to do that. Maybe, he thought to himself, she'll have had her breakfast already, or maybe she'll skip it. But when he got there, she was already seated, picking at a pancake with the shape and consistency of a hockey puck. Hi, he said, not sitting. Hi, she replied, not inviting him to sit down. That was great last night, he said. We talked and talked, did we not? Indeed we did. So, I believe we said we'd meet up here next month. Oh, yes, we did, but now here's the thing, she said. What's that, he asked. Well, I can't make it. I forgot. That weekend I'm going to be staying with some friends in Norwich. You may or may not have been listening to Alexis Sales' Imaginary Sandwich Bar. Thank you. Good night. Alexis Sales' Imaginary Sandwich Bar was written and performed by Alexis Sale. The producer was Joe Nunnery, and it was a BBC Studios production.
And the Sandwich Bar will reopen for business at the same time next week for the final time this series.